when I was involved, especially as a leader, my mother put it in, you know, the terms, colourful terms of her generation, that I stood out like a sore thumb. That's changed. And there's much greater variety, which is important. It's more difficult to stereotype when you say, oh, you know, these are all women, but, you know, they couldn't be more different in their views and attitudes and backgrounds. Mm. So I think that's changed. But what hasn't changed, in fact, I think has got worse, is a really misogynistic streak. So that the stereotyping doesn't take the form of, you know, this is a woman come to clean up the mess, but rather, you know, this is a hateful person. And that misogyny that Julia Gillard faced, but others have as well, is very unpleasant. And I know that every female figure in public view has, you know, a drawful or whatever the equivalent is on the internet of pretty nasty commentary. Mm-hmm. A lot of it around the simple fact that she is a woman.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and victories of inductees to the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the most interesting women across the state. And really, we've made it. 12 weeks, 12 episodes, and most importantly, 12 conversations with 12 fascinating women. It's kind of like the 12 days of Christmas, if they were a bunch of really cool, influential aunties. Our final guest needs no introduction, but I will, of course, give you some for context. Dr. Carmen Lawrence is a well-known name. In 1990, she was the first female premier in Western Australia, and the entire country, for that matter. She's an academic, a climate activist, and currently sits as the chairperson for the Conservation Council of Western Australia. Carmen has been recognised for her trailblazing work for women in politics, both state and federally, which ultimately is what sealed her fate in the Women's Hall of Fame during their inaugural year. It's episode 12 of Herstory with 2011 inductee Dr. Carmen Lawrence. This is Her Story. You are a patron of the WA Netball Association. We've had a couple of netballers in the podcast series this season. Did you play?
Yes, I did as a kid, yeah. That was the game that girls played.
Okay.
Where I grew up, and then later hockey. But yeah, netball was what we played in winter.
What was your position?
I usually played in the centre.
Okay.
I was reasonably fast.
There's a whole school of debate about your position dictates your personality.
Is that right?
I feel like that lands pretty spot on. Yes. Leader of the team, the centre.
I'm not sure that was true, but, you know.
Well, you know, I think it bodes well
until,
for you.
Until about the age of 12, I was the tallest kid in my class. You know, I won all the running races, small community.
Sure.
But, you know, I was fast.
Where did you grow up, Carmen?
Well, I went to boarding school at an early age, but my family located to Murrawar, Gutha, in fact, a little place called Gutha, just before I was born. So part of my growing up was there, and part of it was at boarding school at Dongara, which is not all that far away, actually.
No, yeah. Just up the coast.
Yes, yes.
From Perth, at least.
Yes, that's right.
What was your time at school like? Can you tell us a bit about your childhood?
Well, as a six-year-old, I was sent to boarding school, so that's kind of a big gap in my memory. Maybe I repressed it. I do remember one little incident. I was supposed to be in this school play, and I had a line about Wee Willy Winky.
Okay.
Calls through the night, you know, are your children in bed? It's past 8 o'clock or something like that. And I'd rehearsed for this little play. And then I got a carbuncle and was sent off to the local hospital at Three Springs. And I vaguely remember, this is my only memory from the school there, being aware of the surgeon bending over me, because in those days it was, you know, pretty ordinary and
sure.
Aesthetic, and being conscious as they cut open my leg.
Oh,
I still
no
have the
GA
scar.
At all.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
So I do remember that.
Right, that yeah. Is a standout.
But then I went back to that same school several years later after spending a couple of years in the little convent at Murrawar. So my memories of early schooling are really of Murrawar, catching the bus, you know, smelly sandwiches. Bananas that were going soggy.
Rotting in your school bag.
Yeah, reading comics, you know, swapping them around, you know.
Sure.
All of those things, waiting at the school bus stop, you know, hiding our bikes, all sorts of things, yeah.
Do you remember during the time, maybe throughout sort of later primary school or even through high school, people that you really admired or people that you were able to hear or see in news or on media that you thought were pretty great?
Look, small community is not really like that. You know, people, there's a much greater egalitarian sense. The idea that there's, you know, some boss man or woman out there really didn't cut it. The idea was people could do things together. So if something needed to be done, you would roll up your sleeves and do it. And I suppose being brought up in a religious environment, there were people that we were asked to admire, but they were so remote, they didn't really feel real, and sometimes they weren't, frankly. Some of the stories you get told in the religious upbringing are a bit questionable. But my family, my mum and dad, they were enormously influential, obviously, even though I was at boarding school a lot. Dad was on the local roads board. Mum coached the local hockey team. They did all the things that you do in small communities and pulled their weight,
Yeah. So you come from an upbringing of community and having that sense of community instilled within you from such a young age.
Yes, absolutely. Big family too. Seven kids. We were scattered all over the place most of the time. But we still meet every Friday night. We get together. So that sense of family is also very powerful, and I think that shapes your view of collaboration, cooperation, your place in the scheme of things. You don't get too big for your boots.
Sure. I imagine all these skills and all of this experience has greatly informed what you went on to do with the rest of your life.
Probably difficult for me to say that, but yes, I think so. I've always enjoyed spending time in places where people are working together to achieve outcomes rather than someone sort of big noting themselves as the saviour of the world. I always find that pretty off-putting.
Rightfully so, I think. Before we talk about your political career, Carmen, I want to speak a bit about psychology. Mm-hmm. Where did your interest in psychology stem from?
Well, I started studying it at UWA when I first went there as a 16-year-old. I was a baby, really, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I'd done well at the end of school, and it was just one of the subjects I chose, naively, really, and it fascinated me. I guess I'd always been interested in the question of why people do what they do, so questions of motivation and capacity and the processing of information are obviously what psychology is all about. And there I did have a couple of teachers who were very influential, one of whom is now dead, sadly, but the other of whom is still alive. And they had a powerful impact on my curiosity, really, and a great respect for evidence. So, doing away with the bullshit, if I can use that.
Gosh, can.
And trying to be as faithful to the facts but to inquire, never to accept authority when it came to academic discourse, but always to ask the questions. And they were very powerful influences on me, yeah.
I like the idea of never having to accept what's been handed around or just what you've been told is the right thing to
do. That's right. I mean, that can backfire too. I see that today, where people aren't willing to accept evidence, that becomes questionable. Whereas our training was very much, what is evidence? How is it collected? Who's done the collecting? Are there special agendas at play here? So you ask the questions, but ultimately you accept a reasonable consensus on the evidence.
When you say things like that, Carmen, it automatically brings to mind work that you've done in more recent years for me, uh-huh. sort of in the climate space,
yes.
more so than the political space. Is that sort of how you lended yourself to climate and climate activism?
Well, I was always very interested in the environment and the damage that we were doing to it. And obviously, as a reasonably curious person myself, I was always interested in the whole issue of climate change. In fact, when I was education minister way back when, 1988, we introduced the first curriculum that talked about global warming way back before the original Rio conference. So
wow.
I was interested then. I'm not saying I forced it on the education system, but people's minds were open then to the possibility that we needed to do something about our footprint and that we were, steadily ruining this habitable planet, making it less habitable.
Take us back to 1988. What was the discussion like trying to get that put into the curriculum?
Look, it didn't take a lot because, the science curriculum in our schools, obviously if you were to be a well-informed high school student in the late 80s, early 90s, you needed to know about this phenomenon called the greenhouse gas effect
sure.
or global warming. And the scientists then were very keen for it to be understood. And it wasn't a political issue.
Mm.
The sort of division we've seen develop in Australia didn't exist then. Thoughtful people everywhere were saying this is a matter that we have to properly understand. And so the physics and chemistry of it were, being investigated.
Do you feel like there's been a breakdown when you look at how climate, if at all, is communicated now?
Yes. Sadly, the vested interests kind of struck back and certain political parties have been inclined to listen unduly to their arguments, for want of a better description of their claims. And the result is that it's become a question of identity more than of evidence in some places. I think that's changing again now as the, you know, the problem has become more severe and the consequences more obvious. I think more people have shifted to the, you know, we've got to do something about it camp than, you know, my identity's caught up in denying the significance of climate change.
It's always super interesting, especially when things become politicised that should not be politicised.
That's right.
When it's science or fact, and we've seen it with several different things, with COVID-19 and vaccinations, and then also with the climate. Have you noticed how that has changed over time, or have you seen that happen more? And it's alarming, right?
It is. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened with the advent of social media and people being able to, as they put it, do their own research, is that they people are more likely to be influenced by material that previously they simply wouldn't have had access to. So it's democratized misinformation, if you like, as much as it has information. And if people aren't equipped with the skills to do that sort of careful analysis of, you know, where the data comes from, what the quality of the research on which it's based is like, to be appropriately skeptical but not cynical about expertise, you know. And I think that's, we've had the internet descend on us without necessarily having the tools to manage the information that flows from that kind of spread out. And you know, it's a good thing that there's more information out there, but it's a sad thing that misinformation often gets mistaken for information.
You're caught between a rock and a hard place, right? Because you're told to sort of question things and not just take the status quo. But then also, you're right, if you don't know how to actually do those things or Google them without confirmation bias,
that's right,
you're already bound for failure.
And I mean, there's a bit of a temptation too for some people to say, I mean, you mentioned confirmation bias, it's one of those psychological terms that's, you know, become part of the common vocabulary, but it's tempting for people to say, oh, that's just what humans are like, you know, that you can't, you have to expect that this sort of nonsense will prevail, or at least be, you know, fairly common, because that's what humans are like. But in reality, we are capable of being rational in at the right moments, you know, not having it overwhelm our emotions necessarily, but not having our emotions overwhelm our reason is also very important.
Carmen, tell me about after you finished psychology at UWA. How old were you, and what was your next step?
I was 20, and I spent another year working in a laboratory doing part-time work in order to raise some money, because I was going to do the Australian thing and go for a tour of the world. But I also was accepted to do a PhD at Cornell University. And so I packed up my bags and headed off to the big European tour. In fact, I went through Southeast Asia initially. I went through Singapore and Thailand and then to Greece, to Italy. And
so you did get the world tour in.
Yeah, yeah. I spent a lot of time in Italy, actually, and have been back there several times. I fell in love with it then.
Fabulous. What was your PhD in at Cornell?
I didn't end up doing it at Cornell. I've had a love-hate relationship with psychology. So as I was travelling through Europe, remember this is the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, a lot was going on there. The massive student revolutions were occurring and the anti-Vietnam movement was at its height. There was a lot of argument about the nature of the relationship of citizens with their governments. And psychology, in my book, had betrayed a lot of its first principles, you know, for example, working on ways to influence people when they didn't necessarily want to be influenced, you know, using some pretty questionable techniques, that sort of thing. So I abandoned psychology and just kept travelling for another 6-9 months and then came back to Australia. But I did eventually do a PhD.
You did. You got there.
Yes. But at UWA.
At UWA, back at your home state. Mm. Let's fast forward to 1986. It's when you first enter Parliament in the Legislative Assembly for the seat of Subiaco.
That's right.
What led you to run in that election? Were you always around politics?
Well, as a 20-something-year-old, I was living and working in Melbourne and was involved in the formation of the Women's Electoral Lobby. This is the early 70s when women were basically saying, look, government is not serving us well. Whether you look at the access to childcare or pay rates or control of fertility, all these things were really in pretty rudimentary form. And women were genuinely second-class citizens, you know, not participating in the workforce at the level of their skills, not getting educated to the point where they could, you know, really say that they had flown as far as they could fly. Any area of society you looked at. So I was involved in the formation of the Women's Electoral Lobby, one of 13 who did that. And so for the 72 election, we set out a very clear agenda. We ran a series of interviews and then had form guides in the major newspapers, Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, which rated all of the candidates from stars to plodders. And we used kind of the notion of a horse race. But it was very effective, and Women's Electoral Lobby worked, I think, as well as any organisation has ever done in this country, to raise a series of important issues. So I guess I had a taste for it, also through the anti-Vietnam movement. But then I thought, well, I can be on the side of the table that's making the argument to government, or perhaps I can be in government. So I joined the Labor Party and worked my way through branches and electorate councils and state administrative committees, and then put my hand up for an unwinnable seat in Subiaco. I really thought I was just doing everyone a favour initially. But then it looked like we could win it, and we worked very hard, and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. I was elected.
When we look at sort of elections now, even like the last 10, 15 years, and every election that rolls around, we have in the media those sort of electoral guides and your candidate guides. Yeah. Back in the 1970s, when you started the Women's Electoral Lobby, that must have been pretty groundbreaking to not only have it, but have it published as well.
That's right. It was. It was very unusual. And the initial response of some of the candidates in that election was to be dismissive. But as they saw the momentum grow, and that, you know, if they didn't respond to these requests for interviews and to answer the questions, that they would be singled out, you know. And it was really extraordinary that the major newspapers took what was a novice organisation, really, and gave us that sort of profile. Right up to the Prime Minister. In the end, the Prime Minister McMahon answered the questions, although the interviewers who did, there were two on every occasion just to make sure there was someone with backup, and they reported that he kept turning to his secretary and asking her to answer the questions because he didn't have the information.
Oh, gosh.
Which was really demeaning. And then other people, you know, were really quite curious, and not to say downright ignorant in their responses. One gentleman in Queensland, when asked about whether there are any circumstances where he would contemplate termination of pregnancy being legal, and was asked about rape in particular, and he said, oh, well, if she got pregnant, it wasn't rape.
Oh, no.
So it's pregnancy by consent, apparently. And you've heard that argument now, more recently in the United States, yeah.
The irony of having the Prime Minister of the day have to have his, I'm assuming, female secretary be the translator for an interview.
Yeah.
I love the idea of you starting out in a lobby, but also then just becoming the proof in the pudding and running in the elections. Mm-hmm. When the ballots tallied and they announced Carmen Lawrence for the seat of Subiaco, were you a bit like, oh, now I've got to do it?
There was a moment actually before the election results came down, because we got very confident. We enrolled a whole lot of people who'd never been enrolled before, so we thought Subiaco was winnable. So it was a great honour and delight. But I remember a moment walking down the streets of Subiaco, because it was a big high-profile campaign in a seat that hadn't really been contested for quite a long time, with a sitting member who was kind of established before he resigned in protest at Charlie Court's actions. Anyway, so I'm walking down the street of Subiaco and I hear this kind of whispering behind me, and I thought, oh, bugger, what have I done? You know, my anonymity was blown.
You've questioned the authority. That's what you did. Yeah.
Well, they recognised me, you know, and that's one of those things that you forget, you know, as a private person, and I'm really quite a private person. Suddenly I wasn't anymore. I didn't own my own space in quite the same way as I once had.
You went from private citizen to the most well-known woman in Western Australia at one point, I would imagine.
Sure.
Tell me, how significant was it for women to be in state parliament seats in the 80s and later in the 90s as well?
There was a big flurry of election of women in the 80s, which was fantastic. In the 83 election, 86 when I was elected, I think I was the only one. But there was a significant improvement in the number of women, and for a while really superior to subsequent elections. Not this one, certainly not included.
I think we can discount outlier. The 2021 WA state definite, election.
Definite outlier. So, yes, there was a sense in which women were taking their place, and that, you know, the promises that had been, I suppose, enunciated through Women's Electoral Lobby and other groups, that we would, you know, start to take our place in representative politics, were certainly there, and women were elected to the cabinet here, both by my predecessors and during my time as Premier. So we had a steadily increasing presence of women both in the Parliament and also in the cabinet.
We've spoken with, in a previous episode of Herstory, Libby Stone, a veteran broadcaster in Western Australia and an Australian acting icon as well. And she told us this really great story about how she was one of three women who was working in a Perth newsroom at the time. The headline was "Women are taking over news," when really it was 3 out of 20 women.
Yes.
When we look in politics, there's still a disparity between women and men in parties.
Sure.
Was that a similar headline to this influx of women?
Yes, it was. And when I became Premier, you know, that was a lot of what it was about. You know, the first woman to head a state government, et cetera, et cetera. So it was the sort of first notion. And hard upon the heels, given the circumstances when I became Premier, was the image of, you know, a woman cleaning up the mess. Which a number of people have commented on. It's a pretty typical meme for women.
I didn't think we'd
politics.
Talk about memes today,
there you
Carmen
go,
Lawrence.
But it's one of those ones. Yeah. You know, with a broom in hand. Edith Cowan, for instance, had similar images about her 100 years earlier. So it sort of repeats itself over and over again. Interestingly, one of the headlines, I think it might have been the then Sunday Times, I'm not sure, I might be maligning them. The headline was "Lawrence of Suburbia."
Oh,
kind
gosh.
Overlooking the fact that I had a PhD and that I'd been working in the academy. So I was just a suburban housewife, you know.
Yeah, how do you feel at the time? I mean, 1990, you became, like you said, the first female premier and the only female premier of Western Australia. But you were so much more than just a woman in politics. Mm. I'm sure there were many of those headlines. The press would have been having an absolute field day with this. How did you feel about that when that was the reaction?
I understood it in a way. I mean, I have never eschewed the fact that, you know, I'm a mother and I do housewifely things. You know, I wash and clean and do all those things as well. And so I never want to diminish those. They're important parts of the way people live their lives. But it's when they become a label that attaches to you as if that's the only dimension to your life. You know, even women who are at full time at home with children and doing all those things have other dimensions to their lives. And I think that's it. It's a diminishing way of looking at women. And I know at one stage when I was education minister, there were a bunch of us meeting, I think, in Tasmania, the ministerial council, and there were several women in the group. And the Australian managed to, you know, use a headline that the mothers and grandmothers who are driving Australian education, something like that. I forget the exact wording.
Sure.
But the reference was to our being mothers and grandmothers.
It's the parliamentarians.
Yes, yes. And you'd never see a headline like that about men, the fathers and grandfathers. You know, it just wouldn't make any sense to the reader.
It also does that thing where it diminishes an individual of, you know, an important stature down to domestic roles, which are not to be diminished by any means. It also does that thing where it sort of lessens the blow of any impact that you actually make and go, oh, well, she did it despite, you know, just being a woman from the suburbs.
Yes, that's right. And that whole image of women as being, in a sense, above and beyond politics too, that's a dangerous thing, because in order to succeed in politics, you, given the current state of the play, you have to actually know the rules and how to play them, even when you're trying to change them. So you can't be naive and you can't be an outsider.
At the time when you were elected Premier in 1990, what were you doing to overcome those constant headlines and irrelevant questions that you were being asked?
Yeah, look, I think quite quickly there was a shift, in fairness to the media, away from that, I guess, the more stereotypical representation. And I knew, I guess I felt that I'd broken through some barrier when they stopped calling me Carmen and started referring to me by my surname, which is what you do with men, you know.
It's very true.
It's Morrison, it's Albanese, you know.
It's Lawrence.
Yeah, that's right. So I thought, well, that's a shift that's significant. And although it was nice to be called Carmen, that was a sort of more a feminine appellation, if you like. It wasn't something that they did with men, you know. Mm.
When you look back on your time in Parliament, what are you most proud of? What's the thing or the piece of legislation or the policy or the moment where you look back and go, it was all worth it if just for that?
Well, one of the things that we really had to do was to hold the Royal Commission into WA Inc. And although it was very painful for a lot of my colleagues and there was blowback for me subsequently, you know, a revenge was exacted by some of the people who'd been damaged, it did, I think, shine a light on practices that we hadn't previously been able to examine properly. There was no integrity body, there was no ICAC, there was no means for examining some of these relationships. And basically, laying down a series of statements that said this was not acceptable. You know, this could not be the way that governments operated, whatever their political colour. And it wasn't just the Labour Party, although, you know, it had reached its peak under the Labour government. So although it was painful and although in the end, you know, we lost government, nonetheless, it did, I think, set a benchmark, and Jeff Gallop was then able to build on, when he, you know, some years later became Premier, build on some of the findings. And he was very keen to do that because he'd been part of the cabinet that had made the decision and seen the consequences, yes.
When you say WA Inc., for people who aren't familiar, can you just give us, I know it's a long and a lengthy, convoluted piece to explain.
It was what happened when the relationship between government and business became way too close and decisions were being made in the interests of business people rather than the state's own resources and finances. And rather than stepping back when, you know, there was a major collapse in the international economy and consequences in Western Australia as well with the collapse of a private bank, the government became even more embroiled and were trying to bail out these private operators. So there were lessons, you know, that needed to be underlined and learned about the potential destructiveness of those relationships. And I think we need to learn them again, frankly. I look sometimes at the relationships between business and government. I mean, collectively, not here in Western Australia necessarily. And it seems to me that they're a little too close, you know, that the number of, for instance, fossil fuel companies that get access to government and have a privileged, if you like, route into decision making should worry every Australian, and it's why we need a national integrity body as well. The states all have them now, so if there's any really improper behaviour going on, it's likely to be detected. But at a national level, there's this assumption that if you're in federal politics, you're above it all. Well, I'm afraid that's not true.
The age-old adage of in bed with fossil fuels, right? And or in bed with the mining companies. It's not an unfamiliar sentiment that people across the country really have been hearing.
And it's not a level playing field. If you look at any argument, for instance, around taking another area, destruction of biodiversity, the companies who are likely to be engaged in doing that are very often able to easily get an appointment with a minister. But if you're a community group or a conservation group and you want to get access to the same minister, you'll find it considerably more difficult to do so. You know, in the best of places, those non-government organisations should be funded to be good citizens and are. You know, there are resources from government often placed in the hands of those groups. So their voices can be raised and the arguments about, you know, what we need as a community are heard rather than it being a lopsided debate.
When you were in the political realm, Carmen, did you see or were you thinking back to all of your studies in psychology and being like, this is it on steroids?
Politics.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I guess in a way, motivation in particular, you know, you have to ask questions about what people are really there for. And I must say I concluded that more often than not, people were there because they did want to work in their communities and represent the needs of their the voters who put them there. But others had, you know, perhaps less admirable motives. You know, they were more interested in their own self-aggrandisement and promotion. But I think people overestimate the extent to which that's true. If you get involved in politics, as I say, you need to know how to navigate the system, and that can sometimes look pretty unpleasant. I used to say to people when they asked me why I got involved in politics, because they'd often be, you know, why did you get involved in politics? And I'd say, well, because there are problems to be solved, and that's one level at which you can solve problems. And I'd say to them, do you belong to a tennis club or a church group or an organisation? Sometimes they get pretty ugly too in the process of trying to just, you know, deliver whatever they're doing, you know, tennis match every Sunday or a service, whatever it happens to be. I've seen organisations become, you know, very dysfunctional, and it doesn't just happen in politics. So you have to ask the question, what is it about human behaviour that's causing these breakdowns? And they're very often the same processes, you know, self-aggrandizement, unwillingness to see another person's point of view, revenge, you know, all these things that play out in Shakespeare.
All the makings of a good telenova, yeah.
That's right. They're all there, but they don't necessarily have to be preeminent.
It makes a lot of sense as somebody who got into politics because you saw problems and it was just the right thing to do to get things done. And knowing that you come from a pretty small community and you have grown up in that community environment, all for one, one for all kind of thing. Was that easily translated across to your career, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the best decisions are made from that base. The worst decisions are made when special pleading enters into it But trying to assess what is best is not easy. I think that's the thing that people often overlook, that, you know, you've got contending points of view and needs in a community. Climate change gives, you know, shines the light on that. There are some communities who are going to have to make big changes and others where it will be less obvious and there's less demand placed on them. So understanding that means you've got to make special kind of allowances and make special provision, all of those things. But hearing the right thing to do is often difficult, and devising policies about how to achieve certain outcomes is not easy. I mean, most public policies are big field experiments. You know, we don't know how they're going to work
until we give it a crack, at least be willing or open to hearing it
and learning from others too. You know, I mean, one of the things about public policy is that, you know, there are others have experimented in these fields, whether they're, you know, English speaking countries like us or Scandinavian countries or Southeast Asian countries. People are all grappling with similar problems, and some of them come up with unique and effective solutions. Question is, you know, does it work? Will it work here? Does it work here? And Australia's sometimes been at the forefront of devising those unique, novel solutions that have been, you know, very successful. You know, Australia used to be called a laboratory for democracy. We've fallen a bit short of that recently, but, you know, things like the secret ballot, you know, and compulsory voting, they're Australian inventions, really.
I want to sort of move away from politics in a moment, but I just have a few questions left on that particular part of your career. Mm. You mentioned before this sort of headline or this idea of women coming into office to clean up the mess that was made. That was maybe, and I hope it was sort of an old school way of thinking about the role of women in politics. Do you feel like that has changed now?
I do. I think women have become more mainstream. There are more women. There's a greater variety of women. When I was involved, especially as a leader, my mother put it in, you know, the terms, colourful terms of her generation, that I stood out like a sore thumb. That's changed. And there's much greater variety, which is important. It's more difficult to stereotype when you say, oh, you know, these are all women, but, you know, they couldn't be more different in their views and attitudes and backgrounds. Mm. So I think that's changed. But what hasn't changed, in fact, I think has got worse, is a really misogynistic streak. The stereotyping doesn't take the form of, you know, this is a woman come to clean up the mess, but rather, you know, this is a hateful person. And that misogyny that Julia Gillard faced, but others have as well, is very unpleasant. And I know that every female figure in public view has, you know, a drawful or whatever the equivalent is on the internet of pretty nasty commentary. Mm-hmm. A lot of it around the simple fact that she is a woman.
Yeah. Couldn't have less to do with their actual work. No, it would be more to do with what they wore on X day.
Yeah, yeah. Very unpleasant threats to, you know, at the extreme. So that wasn't the case when I was there. You know, we used to get the odd letter, email in capital letters, underlined, you know, in red. And my staff maintained an angry person's drawer, mainly angry men, and just stick them there. I didn't read them. I didn't need to. And I think that's important. People now on Twitter and social media, they read all this rubbish about themselves. They should just do the equivalent of putting it in the angry drawer and never read it. Reasonable criticism isn't hostile. You know, it can still be criticism. And I'm not saying you ignore criticism. Mm. But when people are just being ridiculously vicious, you don't need to know that. You don't need to take it on. You know, it's like the bad reviewer from a reviewer who has an axe to grind. Don't read it.
If you take nothing else away from this podcast, it's to get yourself an angry man drawer and just stick all the shit in there.
Yeah, that's right.
Really?
That's right.
My final question in the political realm, Carmen, is how are you feeling about WA's politics right now? We did have an election this year in 2021, and something very bizarre happened where there was a Labor landslide, completely and utterly, but a few measly seats in WA.
Right. That's right.
Does that worry you?
It does, actually. I mean, on the night of the election, people were saying how wonderful it was. And I said, look, I'm really delighted that Labor has won, but the margin is too big. That's not healthy. You know, it really isn't. So it will take very considerable discipline by McGowan and his cabinet to avoid misusing the authority that they have. You know, there's a risk of overreach and arrogance and all those things. I'm not saying it's happened, but the risk is there. And I think for a properly functioning democracy, you need a healthy opposition. You do need those other voices. I mean, they can feel very annoying when you're in government, and I can imagine that in some senses it's very comfortable for the government not to have an effective opposition. But it's not good for the country, or for Western Australia in this case, when you have an opposition that is so depleted and demoralised.
You officially retired from political life in 2007 after the federal election, where you ran for the seat of Fremantle. Mm-hmm. What happened after you said, I'm stepping away from politics now?
Well, I returned to my previous career. In fact, one of my former colleagues handed me a banner that the Daily News used to have outside the newsagents, and when I'd actually gone back into to federal politics. Lawrence resumes her career. So I went back to the academy.
What have you been doing the last few decades?
<That's right. laughs> Yes, so the UWA very kindly took me back to set up a Centre for the Study of Social Change, and then my colleagues in psychology convinced me to go and join them there and to run a program for third-year students, applying psychology to contemporary social problems, which was a great challenge. Everything from education to health to terrorism to immigration to conservation, climate change, all the things that policy needs to be made about to try and understand what psychology could contribute to understanding.
And how do you feel about that now? Psychology contributes greatly to those things. You saw it firsthand, both studying it and then also living that life in politics. How do you feel about it in a tertiary space?
Well, I think it's a very difficult area, because people often say how difficult climate change is to understand for the average citizen, and there are so many variables contributing to the shifts that we see, and it is easy to, in a sense, become sceptical about what we know, but it's very complicated. And I say to people, if you think climate change is difficult, human behaviour is orders of magnitude
You've got
more
no
difficult.
Idea.
There's just so much we don't know. But we can point to certain sort of, trends and tendencies and understanding them. But again, asking the question, why is this happening to this society? Why are Indigenous people being incarcerated at the rates that they are? Now, honestly, the psychology there that we need to understand is the psychology of the decision makers. Why do we continue to allow children to be incarcerated at the age of 10? What is it people are thinking when they judge that to be a reasonable response? What happens when police are surveilling their community? Why do they more often stop Aboriginal people for just going about their business? So that the understanding those things and trying then to intervene to shift attitudes is very important, I think. Yeah.
One of the things that takes up a lot of your time now is not only sort of running in that space in the academic world, but also in the conservation world. You're the president of the Conservation Council of Western Australia. Right. How did that role come about for you?
I was invited to put my hand up for the position, and I was happy to do so because it's an area that I've always felt very strongly about. I made decisions sometimes that weren't entirely consistent with that, being, part of a government. But I'd bought up bits of land as well, the bush blocks, and had started to become involved at a grassroots level too. So it was a great honour to be invited, and I think I've got another year to go before we have to change horses again.
Oh, no, election time again.
No, I think our constitution requires at a certain point, which is a good idea, that you move on. But, our role is basically to support the paid staff, and we're very pleased to have been able to expand the Conservation Council. This is a time where philanthropists are more interested in providing funding for instance, climate change campaigns and things like protecting Ningaloo Reef. And so the funding that used to be very hard to come by is, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier, and we're able to employ people on better salaries for longer contracts. So you get a better opportunity to both make sure the community is aware, but also to practically lobby government with credible data, which is obviously important. If you're running an entirely voluntary organisation, it's tough to do that.
You're the president of this Conservation Council at such a pivotal time. I mean, more now than ever, people are aware of and talking about climate change and global warming and the need to act on it. Some people are still denying it, which is absolutely bonkers. you're in this really great position in such a pivotal time, but does it ever frustrate you that you've been talking about this and literally putting it in school curriculums all the way back in the 1970s?
80s.
80s.
But yes, it is frustrating, but I'm also conscious of the fact that change takes time. It's generational sometimes. The tragedy is we don't have any more time left on climate change. And I think that sense of urgency has finally started to galvanise decision makers. We'll wait and see what happens in Glasgow. But we're keen, through a body that we've set up called Clean State, to show how it is possible to transition to economies that are not generating more of the problem that we already have, you know, no more global warming, that you actually can go carbon neutral and even carbon negative while improving people's quality of life. Quality being the critical thing. I mean, I think in the West we've become wedded to more as if it meant better.
Mm.
And what we've got to do and what we're trying to do is show that you can have better. The quality of people's lives, including their health and well-being, will be very significantly improved if we make these transitions. It's not a loss, it's a gain.
Do you ever feel, Carmen, like you wake up sometimes and you go, oh, I have to do it again today. I have to fight the power again. Do you ever have moments like that?
I have had, yes. Yeah.
How do you overcome that?
I guess just take the next step. You know?
Just keep going.
Or sometimes pull the doona up, which I can do now. In the past, you just had to keep moving one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as I say, that sense that you're not, in the end, pivotal necessarily. You have responsibilities and you take on responsibilities, but there's a generation, yours and even younger, coming through who are committed, energetic. They are doing the things that I did in my 20s, and you have to be, I guess, conscious of the need to make those transitions. There's nothing worse than people who don't know that they are actually not indispensable.
How do you feel looking then at the younger generation, at the millennial and then Gen Z generation coming through now, who do have such an appetite for change in the climate?
Well, it does remind me of myself at that age. I mean, you think you're bulletproof, that's the first thing, and you think you know everything, that's the second thing. But they're the things that enable you to challenge the status quo. If you were entirely satisfied with the status quo, then it wouldn't move. I mean, as I mentioned, well, and that shift on the position and status of women wouldn't have happened without women saying, come on, we've got to change this. This is not acceptable. So my time teaching at UWA, I'm not teaching any longer. I'm emerita. But it enthused me because the young people I encountered were very encouraging to that view. They didn't necessarily agree with every analysis that I might have trotted out, but that they were willing and able to look at the world, you know, in a pretty kind of clear-eyed way, and were willing to roll up their sleeves. Not all of them, but it's never everybody. You know, people sometimes used to say to me, you know, they were around in the 60s when all this anti-Vietnam and, you know, pro-women stuff was happening. And I look at them and say, no, you weren't. You were wearing the clothes, but you weren't doing the work.
Do you feel like a sense of at least a bit of relief going, okay, there is a population of people in the next generation who do get it and are willing to continue that fight?
Yes, and I think there's a responsibility of people of my generation, the so-called boomers. I hate those distinctions. But but people who have the means particularly to support that next generation, whether it's through philanthropy or what they know or what they can do. I'm still involved in a conservation group in Margaret River on the board there, working with people to eradicate arum lilies, for example, and to reduce the weed infestation of our natural environment. So you can continue to do, you know, a lot of good, well, I hope, in small ways, where maybe your energy and your enthusiasm is a little depleted compared to when you're 20. I have
Fair
to confess
enough.
That's true.
That's, like, understandable. You've done a lot of things, Carmen Lawrence. Yes. I think we can let you sleep in just for a bit longer. You are a part of the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame, which is what this podcast is based around, inducted in its inaugural year in 2011. When you received that email or that phone call saying, oh, hi, we'd like to induct you, this is a new thing, what did you feel when that came through?
Well, I was obviously very pleased and honoured. But part of me always thinks with these awards and hierarchies and noting the, you know, the leaders and the best, and, you know, whether it's in politics or anywhere else, yeah, but what about all the people who didn't get the public notoriety/recognition? So I always hope that I stand for all those women whose names are not up there, but who've made contributions that are in many ways even more admirable. So, yeah, important, I think, to recognise that these are frameworks that help us to make sense, you know, the highs and the lows of political life, but they don't represent reality.
No, but you hope the people who have been recognised do exactly what you've just done and really do help draw attention to the greater mass of people that are performing those roles.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the Australian honours system, I think, is deficient. It's not only does it not have as many women as it should, but probably the reason it doesn't have as many women as it should is because a lot of those people are doing solid community work without the need for, you know, public recognition. And they're not recognised, unfortunately. So I frankly would rather do away with the honours system. I don't see that it serves any useful purpose.
The name of this podcast is Herstory. Is this a term that you've come across before?
Yes, yes.
How do you feel about it?
Well, I think it's a good way to remind people that women's history is thin in a lot of cases, you know, that because we tend to write history in terms of the, you know, the public figures, the great men, we lose sight of the fact that women have been doing these things, you know, supporting their communities, often at a level that's not dissimilar. I mean, if you think of the world of music, for example, classical music, for instance, there are women composers who've just been forgotten over the generations who were at least as good as many of the men who are still being played today. Mm. And I'm delighted, for instance, I love classical music, that ABC Classic FM are now, you know, from time to time, digging out, you know, some of the recordings that have obviously been made by somebody of these women composers long forgotten. And it's true everywhere you go. But also not recognising the role that women have played because of the way that our societies have been organised in making things possible. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not always out the front, you know, wielding the baton, so to speak. But without them, it wouldn't have been possible for anyone to do that.
Mm. It's so interesting that you mentioned there about classical music and female composers. Yeah. We've spoken to a woman named Margaret Sears,
yes,
who I'm sure you've crossed paths with.
I know
some
Margaret,
stage.
Yes, I do.
So pretty much exactly in that realm of classical music, I mean, a specialisation in 18th century keyboard music, yes, I think, is what she holds.
Yes.
And is one of those women that I think, you know, unless you know, you would be hard-pressed to tell me who Margaret Sears is.
That's right.
But such an important figure.
Yes, yes, and she has had a very important role in the arts and at UWA, you know, and nationally in the arts as well. But again, you know, not someone to big note herself.
No.
Simply getting on with the job and much admired in the world that she inhabits and has inhabited, but not necessarily, you know, up there in lights with some of the figures who are more able to promote themselves. And I think of some of the entrepreneurs in this state who managed to craft a reputation for themselves, which is sometimes, frankly, ill-deserved.
How do you want to be remembered, Carmen?
Look, I hope that the people who remember me are people who actually care about me, you know, as a politician. When it got tough at times, and it did, I would look in the mirror and say, who would care if you fell under the bus tomorrow? And remind myself then of those people who do care, my family, my friends, and people I've worked with, you know, that I've grown to call my friends. So I'd like to be remembered as a friend, as a mother, as a sister. I can't say daughter anymore because my mum and dad are dead. But, you know, for the relationships that I've cultivated rather than the big splash that I might or might not have made.
Before we let you go, we are a radio station, RTR-FM, and we play a lot of music. It is part of quite literally our licence to do so here. We've asked everybody if they can provide us just the name of or an example of an artist or a song that you love and you'd like for us to play as part of this project. Do you have a favourite song or a favourite type of music or artist?
You're putting me on the spot here because my son is a musician.
Is he really?
Yes.
What kind of music does he make?
And I love his music. He's a singer-songwriter, guitarist, keyboard, banjo, voice.
He's an overachiever like his mum.
So he plays with a band called Mr. and Sunbird.
Okay.
And there are a couple of songs on their last CD. CDs are a bit of a thing in the past. And I feel slightly embarrassed and a bit indulgent suggesting that one of his tracks, Bomp and Roll, maybe, or there's one about Lady Macbeth, which is fabulously dark.
I think we should keep it in the family then and definitely play one of
those. But I love music. I love music. So the fact that I have a son who's a musician in these difficult COVID times is a matter of great joy for me. Yeah.
Well, we better play and celebrate that then.
I think so.
Thanks to Dr. Carmen Lawrence and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. They've all been incredibly generous in this entire process. And now we find ourselves saying thank you for the final time to all the women who made Herstory happen. Really, without this team, the entire series would not have happened. Our executive producer, editor, sport devotee and all-round legend is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale are our assistant producers. They spent countless hours researching, listening to and learning from all the inductees part of this series, all future Hall of Famers, I say. Our theme music is an original composition from Borlu virtuoso Annika Moses. Seriously, check out their work if you haven't already. Artwork from the insanely talented Peter Roebuck. Head to the RTRFM website for an entire write-up of what it all means and book Peter for your next public mural. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to our podcast. If you're listening on an app, please subscribe and leave a rating. It does help do all the algorithm things. If you're listening through the RTRFM website, thanks too. You can always show your support for local music and stories by subscribing to your community radio station, just like RTRFM. Till next time, go well.